Well, hello everybody. Pastor Connor here. We're going to dive in, keep working through the Augsburg Confession. Before we begin, a few announcements. Let me just adjust this camera a bit more. Of course, last time I saw you, about a month ago, before that, I think it was even longer than a month. Been busy, of course. I want to let everybody know that the commentary on the Creed in Dr. Luther's Small and Large Catechism is done. If anyone wants that, just reach out either by YouTube comment or by email. If you email, don't email the Transcendent Truth email. I don't often look at that, but you can email my personal email if you would like to do that at cwlongafi@gmail.com. I'll send that to you. We're not going to be releasing it in paperback or Kindle until the Lord's Prayer commentary is done, and then putting them together as volume two on the commentary of the catechisms and articles of Dr. Luther. And of course, that project is just going to keep rolling until the entirety of the breadth of the Small and Large Catechism and the Small Called Articles is completed. And then the primary text will be removed, and we're going to try and see if we can print it all together as one fat tome, and then also have the individual set, so or the individual volumes in a set. What else? Yeah, I mean, some personal stuff. People who know me know that. People who don't, they'll find out on Facebook anyways. So, all right, let's begin. We're picking up at Article on Monastic Vows 27, and this is part three in our series on this text. And we have come to verse 30, or sorry, paragraph 31, not verse, but paragraph 31, talking about monasteries and monastic vows. Now, in the past, as to what we have covered previously, Melanchthon has been talking about, hold on, I'm just trying to adjust the video here. Yeah, Melanchthon has been talking about the abuse of monasticism, people trying to, as with all of these abuses that Melanchthon is working with, and as we've seen, like through this whole series, the main issue that Melanchthon always has with this stuff is not actually the thing itself. I mean, like in little part it is, right? Like he would always tweak some of the practices a little bit, but by and large, the majority of his problem is theological. It's that these people are doing this practice and saying it's a sin not to do it, or that doing it merits justification. Like that itself is a huge issue. Of course, also with this is the forsaking of honoring one's father and mother through marriage, through the continuance of the family line. And that's a big thing as well. And if anyone hasn't read the first volume in that commentary series I was talking about earlier, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it on the website, Transcendent Truth website. You can find it wherever you find it, right? It's sold by Amazon. But we go over that like in length, at tedious length. And why do we do that? Because today's culture has so missed that. And while it's a secular, kind of pluralistic, atheistic culture, it's doing a sort of monasticism. It's doing a sort of forsaking of the family. It's doing a sort of forsaking of the sexual nature of humanity in the same sort of way. It's forsaking the good of children, the good of matrimony, the good of procreation, not in silent, isolated personal prayer, or not even personal, but for the whole world, as a monastic kind of vocation, what would have been. And that's not good itself, right? Forsaking those things is not good itself. But it's an isolation, not even for prayer, just for pleasure, right? But it's this kind of perversion of monasticism, in which case you have all the bad stuff of monasticism, but there isn't even a silver lining. Like there isn't even a good intention. But that's those same kinds of things remain, right? It's, Melanchthon, one of Melanchthon's issues was this is a complete forsaking of those laws of God, the honoring of the father and the mother, the good of marriage, the good of the law, the good of nature. And that same stuff is happening in atheistic, pluralistic, secular society. So this is extremely important that we understand as We contemplate what a proper sort of monasticism would look like. And of course, you can find like Lutheran monastic stuff, and it's not the way that I'm going to say, right? I am going to say something. But so, for example, like what you see there in the Lutheran monastic stuff, whether they be monasteries or nunneries, is the removal of the idea that it justifies you. The removal that it is a higher vocation than normal life, and the removal of lifelong vows that bind people. So it's kind of like a temporal living arrangement. Although, yeah, and he speaks here as well, as we've seen already. Melanchthon speaks of the good of old monasteries, in which they used to be like universities that you'd go for a time to live in for, prayer and education, basically a seminary. And I mean, seminaries are basically still like that. You don't really leave the seminary when you're in seminary. That's kind of your whole life for 4 years at least, and then you're done, right? And then you go back to normal life. But these Lutheran monasteries are not like that, and they're not really centers of education and learning. They are mostly centers of isolated prayer. So they still have those things which could be tweaked to make them better. But even so, you look at some of what the liberal, super liberal, and weird schismatic Catholic and Orthodox groups do, where you'll find these married guys and they'll call themselves monks and nuns and stuff. Well, I mean, sure, but what does that mean? And this is where I think we get to a realization of what would be most proper, a democratization of the idea of monasticism, or a universalizing of the idea of monasticism, kind of like the universal priesthood. You also have a universal monkhood, the monkhood of all believers, if you will, that all people are called to do the good things that monks and nuns are called to do, live lives of vocational learning, lives of vocational prayer, lives of vocational service and love to others. That's not something that only pertains to people in robes. That pertains to those, well, I'll say this, though, that pertains to those who are robed in the righteousness of Christ, which is you, right? And so you should be living in this vocation of your universal monkhood, the monkhood of all believers. And if we want to talk about ministerial monastic life, it can't really exist. And why do I say that? Because it's when we say, well, it's not a universal monkhood, it's a vocational monkhood, we're not doing justice to the matter, because the vocation of all people is to be monkish in the good way: learning, prayer, service, work, love, right? Those things are universal calls and universal vocations, universal placements and tasks that God gives them to do. But the other side of that universal is the ministerial, and the ministerial relates to service to others. You can't really serve others, like in that sense, in isolation, right? You can only do it in that universal sort of way. Now, if we wanted to say we're gonna pay someone, because that's like really what people are telling, like there's really no other way to distinguish between that universal monkhood and someone who says, yeah, well, I'm a monk in a specialer way. Well, what does that mean? Are you paid for it? People who want to live in cloistered life, are we just talking about having Christian roommates? Because that's fine, but like, so this begs all these sorts of questions, in which case we see this idea of anything other than the idea of basically paid staff or total isolation, which isn't good, just doesn't really make any sense, and it's a little bit silly. On the other hand, I don't think that we should lose sight of the idea of monastic and ascetic life. I just think everybody should be doing it, if that kind of makes sense. And people will say, well, you can't, that's way too harsh. That's, what are you saying? On one hand, you're against the monasteries. On the other hand, everyone needs to be the monasteries. I mean, yeah, that's kind of the situation, right? Because for all of the good that monasteries do, most of them are tucked away in the woods. Why? For this glorification of isolation, which is not actually, it's not actually good. Now, urban monasteries, they can do a lot better work, but if they're really doing it, they don't have any time to be isolated. However, I think they need to be praying just as much as they are praying, but in service and love to other people. When they do that, I think that's a really great thing. But here's what I have to say as well. And it's something that the old patristic fathers of our church, monastic and not, said this too. It's no less holy. It's really no less holy to be living out your vocation properly as a mother in the urban city than it is to be in a cave. But I'll go further. It is holier, right? Because it is, right? Now, if you say, I want to live in the urban society and not be married because I feel, I don't know, I'm a asexual or whatever. Well, whatever, fine, right? Fine. But like, for most people, they need to realize, as our confession said, and this is something that a lot of, confessed, I'll say confessed, not confessing, because I don't think they're doing it properly, but people who think that they're confessional Lutherans, glorifying singleness as this choice. I mean, people in modern West, they love their choices. They love their self-directed lives. They think it's totally fine to just stay single as long as they want, stay childless as long as they want. That's not the Book of Concord's idea. They don't share that with the confession that they claim to believe. And I know that they find that really unbelievable because of the modern narrative of the evangelical Protestant churches glorifying singleness, which has been pushed in these latter times. But the text is the text. And now, speaking of the text being the text, let's look at this text. Melanchthon says some canons and papal laws annul vows made under the age of 15 years. And this is talking about vows taken by people too young, people who didn't know what was really the substance of the vow that they were taking on themselves. So he says, for they take into consideration that before this age, a person does not have sufficient understanding to decide how possibly to determine or arrange an entire life. Now, this is an interesting thing relating to confirmation age, because, as some people have said, confirmation needs to be younger. And, depending on where you live, that age will vary. In Canada, where I live for a long time, that age started at 14 and it terminated at 16. And the reason it did is text like this, right? Is people talking about, well, they're not 16, or sorry, they're not capable of realizing how they want to rearrange their life and whether they want to be Christians or not. Of course, the proper response to this is, well, they are Christians. So confirmation should not be held off for this reason. What Melanchthon is talking about here is vocation, right? How they want to live in that. Like, they're already Christians. They can't decide not to be. You already are one, right? Now he says another canon concedes still more years to human frailty, but forbids taking monastic vows before the 18th year. And also 18th year, I have seen confirmations done at 18 year, especially in what's called, the Dutch Reformed Church, not the Lutheran Church, but the Dutch Reformed Church is generally where they will do their equivalent of that, right? And also in our churches, 18 is usually where you become a voting member. But again, that's not what Melanchthon is actually referring to here. This provides an excuse and reason for a great many to leave the monasteries, for a majority entered the monastery in childhood before attaining such an age. Now, some will say, and Pastor Connor, why are you talking about confirmation? Because this section of paragraphs, or really what I would call a paragraph with three verses, 31 through 33, has been cited by many ex-Lutherans who become Baptists or Charismatics, and they say, look, you have this idea of, and maybe it's not even the text, but the idea of, I was baptized as a child, I was confirmed too young, I want to make my faith my own, I wasn't old enough to decide what I was taking on, right? Melanchthon's not talking about that. Melanchthon is talking about this vocation, especially a vocation of singleness. By the way, there is really no vocation of singleness. There is only a sort of, Jesus speaks of sort of as a gift, indirectly as a gift. It is only given to some that they would be able to do this, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a gift. Paul says it is a better thing, but as a sort of thing commanded. Well, it's never commanded. It's actually the opposite is commanded. So we have to be kind of careful how we speak of singleness. But the way that they were speaking of singleness in the institutional monastic life, they did speak of it as a vocation. And by the way, it was basically a paid vocation in which they became professional prayer people, Right? He says, finally, even if the breaking of monastic vows might be censured, it could not be concluded from this that the marriage of those who broke them should be dissolved. Now, this is also interesting as it pertains to divorce and remarriage. For example, if you look at the Roman Catholic Church, they're still kind of operating in the way that Melanchthon is seeing them operate here, in which case you will find, something that I would also consider an unlawful divorce. Of course, I believe that there are lawful divorces, and Rome doesn't really. But they will say, you have to then break up that second marriage. That second marriage is an adultery. And there's still room to sort of debate that, but that sort of idea is pertaining here. They would say, because they're in that second marriage needs to be done away with. But Melanchthon is saying, even if it was bad, so hypothetically, and that's why that kind of does pertain to this, even if, granted, even if, such as, for example, say the divorce was unlawful, they're now in a second marriage, should that be broken up? And you have an entire book about this, basically, right? You look at that situation in the Ezra and Nehemiah kind of epoch, kind of corpus. We have all of those marriages broken up, and what's the fallout from that? Well, all of those wives are kicked out and scattered. All of those kids are left fatherly and abandoned, fatherless and abandoned, right? Is that something that God commanded? No. Is that something that he blessed? He doesn't say he does, right? It is this kind of wholly destructive thing that was done by a party that took it upon themselves to kind of reason through their ethics and said, yeah, this is the righteous thing to do. And the outcome of that is fatherless kids, abandoned women, right? Now, for Saint Augustine, cited in Marriage Matters, says that marriage should not be dissolved. Now, what, of course, like, what does that mean? That marriage should not be dissolved? Any marriage? A second marriage? A third marriage? A fourth marriage? Right? I mean, that's a genuine question. Because there are, for example, if you know anyone who's been in missions in certain places of the world, they will tell you that it's not uncommon that you're going to be ministering to men who have two, three, four, five, six wives at one time. Right? And then they have this question, which one do you keep, right? At least in, for example, a lot of Baptist and Reform circles, and they would say you have to dissolve all the other ones, or you have to not live with the other ones and they can't remarry. The different groups will solve it different ways, but this is a valid, it's a super valid question. If marriage should not be dissolved, on what grounds will you dissolve those marriages? Will you do it on the Roman sort of grounds where you say it's an annulment, they were never really married? Well, what does that mean, right? And we look at David and Solomon, who had many wives. Were they fake wives? What does that mean? We look at Isaac and, we have all, or sorry, Jacob, you have all of these sorts of situations where there are multiple wives in the scriptures spoken of as multiple wives, multiple marriages, not as fake wives, not as fake marriages. So, of course, Rome will talk about that law changing. But whether it's changing or whether Rome is just doing something incorrect is unclear. He says, now Saint Augustine certainly does not have a low reputation in the church, even though some have subsequently differed from him. And he's referring, of course, to Rome themselves, even though Rome didn't think that they were. So he says, although God's command concerning marriage frees and releases many from monastic vows, our people offer still more reasons why monastic vows are null and void. Now he's saying here, what's he saying? God's command to get married nullifies your monastic vow, which is not to get married, right? Why? Because one is instituted by God, the other is instituted by human beings. And God's law takes precedent. Not only precedence, it's the only really valid law there. Unless we're talking about a civil law, which is indirectly instituted by God, right? Now, Rome's idea here is just as the civil law is indirectly instituted by God, such that God gives the authority to the state to wield the sword and to set up laws and to order society, so also indirectly the Lord God gives the spiritual kingdom and that authority to the church, and they'll cite their, the keys of the kingdom given to Peter, and then whatever you loose on heaven will be loose, sorry, loose on earth will be loosed in heaven, whatever you bind will be bound in heaven. And they refer this to, that is a rabbinic sort of teaching. In which case they understood you can invent laws and stuff. And that's literally how they argue it, and that's fine, right? We understand that. Well, that's what they're saying. But on the Lutheran side of this, no, there is only one sort of source of theological authority by which truth can generate and exist and not be created, but, be derived from. And that's the Lord God and His word and His law. So We continue. Continuing with this idea, he then quotes, "In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines." And that is, that's a translation thing here, as doctrines of God. St. Paul also teaches, he says elsewhere, that righteousness is not to be sought in our precepts or services of God. Again, this comes back to Melanchthon's constantly, his only ever like serious, real issue with this stuff. And it's the theological issue. But that righteousness and innocence before God come from faith and trust when we believe that God receives us in grace for the sake of Christ, his only Son. And this, of course, comes in, this begs that whole question of universal objective justification.